The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Anyone involved in manufacturing knows how complicated the process of designing, building, and shipping a product can be. At UW-Milwaukee, a great deal of thought and expertise is devoted to the study of those supply chains between a customer and the manufacturer. Well, on this edition of UWM Today, we're talking with Anthony Ross, who is the Rockwell Automation Endowed Chair in Supply Chain Management in the Lubar School of Business. Anthony and his colleagues have been exploring a fascinating question in the business world, and that is asking whether it's better to remanufacture or refurbish an item rather than simply building and selling a new one. Anthony, great to have you back on the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to see you again.
And for those who don't know, did I do justice to the definition of supply chain?
I think you did. You and I last visited a few years ago, and sounds like you're ready to go to work in supply chain now. So that means I've done a good job with our conversations.
Well, a lot of companies, I suspect most companies have some need of understanding that link between what they do, what they make, and the customer at the other end.
They do. And if I may take your definition and your description of the supply chain and just, you know, cull it down into the how firms plan, source, make, and deliver, and then recover their products, because we have to think about product life cycles long after the company has actually sold that product to a customer.
Is that a problem that some companies don't understand that linkage all the way through?
I think companies generally understand it. I think more and more what we're seeing today is that post-sales stage of the product life cycle, after the company has sold the product, is what we call the remanufacturing phase of a product life cycle, where products that last, say, greater than 3 to 5 years, things like off-road equipment, things like electronics of certain classes, things like industrial automation equipment, companies must now be thinking about, well, geez, how do we support that product to the very end of its life without having to always build a new product to sell to that same customer?
And that's part of the research that you and your colleagues have been working on.
It certainly is. Certainly is. And we call that the remanufacturing.
So how did you go about posing this question to the companies that are involved?
Yeah, sure. Well, if we think about remanufacturing as an industry itself, an industrial sector, that industry is worth about $43 billion based on 2011 figures a year in terms of the value of product for remanufacturers. And if you look at the kind of companies that classify themselves as remanufacturers, by and large, these are small to medium-sized firms, which is of, I would say, of some import to the Wisconsin economy. And so companies must now be thinking about how do they support their customers long after the purchase of that product. And that support could be in repair, refurbishing, certainly replacing, but also remanufacturing that product in certain smaller scale ways that lead to more efficient and effective use of resources in support of their customers.
Is this the result of a product let's call it a piece of machinery that you use to make something? Is it a matter of the thing just wearing out after making thousands of copies of whatever the machine is involved in creating?
Sure.
Or is it a result of new technology coming along that might make that process smarter or
sure.
more economical?
Yeah, and it's actually a combination of both, and it's context specific. And let me give you an example. Let's say we have high-tech oriented products that are driven by some sort of what we call firmware or computer programs embedded in them. Well, over the life of that product, that software must be upgraded. But at some point in time, the software that in turn drives the mechanical movement of that piece of equipment, those parts must be replaced as well. And just one example is, you know, if you look at the General Mills company, They make food that we consume. And one of the types of foods that they make is snack foods, chips, pretzels, whatever the case may be. Well, there's a plant here locally, here in Milwaukee, that produces 21 million cases of snack foods every year here in Milwaukee. Now, think about that on a daily basis. So the kinds of machines that are making the pretzels or the chips or the snack fruit bars, or the kinds of machines that are closing the packages and doing the packaging on that snack food. Those machines, as you said, get a lot of wear and tear. And so the equipment that drives those machines is really what we're talking about that needs to be managed and replaced during its entire life cycle.
So when you're asking manufacturers what's better for them, how do you go about posing that question? Does it come down to just the pure cost of a new machine versus refurbishing, or are there other factors that come into play?
Sure, sure. And let me see if I can give you and your listeners a reasonably clear response to that question. So let's imagine Subway, and we all we're familiar with the Subway sandwich shops.
Had one for lunch today.
Oh, did you? We need to share. When you walk into a Subway shop and start the order process, the first thing they ask you is, what type of bread and what size bread? And then you look through as you move down that assembly line, you look through the window and you see all of the vegetables that are nicely organized into these compartments, and they assemble your sandwich. And you pay for it. They ask you some questions, interact with you. You pay for it, and then you leave. But when we talk about large-scale industrial manufacturers, right, like the brewery with our friends down on Juneau Avenue at Miller Coors or the General Mills plant, these companies have the kinds of production processes that are a much larger scale. And as we think about the kinds of components that go into the machines that actually make their product, those machines, those components are going to give way and fail. And so those machines then have to be replaced and sent, in many cases, sent back to the company for repair. And so the question is for that manufacturer, that OEM manufacturer, should I send the customer a new product? Or should I repair the existing product? And there are lots of challenges associated with that decision. On the one hand, it could be a warranted product that the customer gets free repairs for some period of time. But the product is not under warranty from the customer's perspective, then they have to pay for the remanufacture or the repair. Now, if you're the manufacturer, that poses two very significant and different financial options. If you're repairing product that is not under warranty, that's a revenue stream for the company, and that's advantageous for the company in many respects. But if that product is under warranty, then the manufacturer essentially pays the cost of that repair for the customer, and that could be quite expensive. And so companies have to wrestle with these decisions as to what's the cost to them to support the product, but at the same time, how do they continue to maintain that customer in their customer base?
And one of the other questions I suspect here is what is going to help you be most competitive if you're the company with that big machine, right?
Absolutely.
I end up using perfectly fine a machine that was built 5 years ago, another 5 or 10 years in the same way it was used?
Sure.
Or do I get a machine that could do it quicker, faster?
Absolutely.
And maybe even save money on the energy that it costs to use that machine.
Absolutely. The energy and the labor inputs to operate that machine, because now if it's a newer technology machine, it's probably easier to operate and maintain and monitor on behalf of the production workers. And so that's kind of highlight the motivation for our project study that was graciously supported by the leadership at Rockwell Automation, and in particular the Mequon, Wisconsin plant, and Mr. Mark Catry, and my wonderful colleague who wasn't able to join us today, Professor Wilka Star Otieno, in the School of, I guess we call it CSEES, the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences on the UWM campus.
Right. And so how far along are you in the study?
Right. So this particular study was motivated to address those remanufacturing kind of challenges. And we began this study about a year ago, late last summer. And that included bringing not only faculty and corporate managers together, but also our doctoral students. We call them emerging researchers. And so we had the opportunity to put these doctoral students from both the engineering school and the business school out in real companies to be able to start to examine these problems and bring to bear some very sophisticated techniques and tools for analyzing the actual manufacturing processes. Because if you go back to the Subway example, when you move down the line and choosing your vegetables, well, now we're moving down the line, and instead of choosing vegetables, we're choosing components. How companies decide to orchestrate their direct laborers to what we call make the production decisions relative to rebuilding or remanufacturing that item really matters because of labor costs, because of the labor skill sets required, and how do they assign very expensive labor versus lower cost labor to the remanufacturing of those products. So these are very important business decisions for the firms.
Any findings, any conclusions yet?
Yeah, so our results are looking at so we've just entered the phase where we've validated the model. So we have a model now that fairly accurately replicates the work of those frontline production employees within reason. And so now the next phase for us in this project, Tom, is to design a series of experiments that look under how that production line or work cell operates under varying workload conditions. And given current policies for labor staffing in that production environment, how do they go about improving upon their current labor assignment policies and the requisite skill sets? Because what we're talking about is time. The longer it takes to remanufacture a product, the more expensive it is. And moreover, the way they design the processes for remanufacturing may be improved as a result of our studies. So we're about to enter that design phase to actually answer those specific questions of how can we get better.
You know, as you describe the labor component, the people who have to actually fix these machines, I think of my father-in-law, a wonderful fellow who's since passed away, but he spent his career as a field engineer for FMC traveling around the world fixing machines. He worked up in the Green Bay plant where they made the machines that packaged cheese, little slices of cheese or crackers. And you couldn't go out with my father-in-law without him reaching into the basket of crackers or the plastic utensils and say, well, this came off of a F-72-90. And see, there's a little crinkle here. Sure. But the thing that comes to my mind as I recall this wonderful fellow who fixed these machines is the little black book that he carried around. And Jim was always in demand because customers down in Brazil or over in Germany said, well, we bought the machine from Green Bay, but not anybody could fix it. We need to get the guy who actually knows just how to tune it, just how to get it running properly.
Machine.
And I always thought, what if he lost the black book? Lost this little notebook? And I suspect on a larger scale, that must be an issue that all of these companies are concerned with.
Absolutely. And more so today, we see that firms that produce these kinds of products, so we're talking about consumer and industrial durable goods. And what we're seeing today in this e-commerce, high-tech age, that more and more of today's industrial automation technologies have that kind of technology where the history of performance of that machine and the environment in which that machine actually works is being monitored. And that data can then be analyzed to understand how to build a better widget, if you will, by that company's design engineers.
I think there's a name for that. Don't they call it the Internet of Things?
The Internet of Things and the connectivity. So many devices are there that collect data for us to analyze.
And, you know, that actually was in the news recently with the disappearance of the airline in the Southern Pacific, in the Pacific Ocean.
Flight 370, yes.
Right. And I remember that reading stories about how there were sensors sending off via satellite all sorts of information about the operation of the engines and the stress on the plane.
Absolutely.
That is an example of this Internet of Things.
Absolutely. And our ability to monitor the operation of our equipment up to the second or even millisecond in some case when you think about medical devices such as pacemakers.
Is this a new development? How long have we had this data stream coming off of these machines?
Well, the data in terms of the collection of that data is really relatively new. And what I mean by relatively new, I'd say probably 15 to 20 years. And that is a relatively short period of time given that industrial automation actually began in the 1850s in England. Right. So it took us, about 130, 40 years to get to this point where we have the technology that allows us to do more real time up to the second or millisecond reads on our processes in manufacturing.
You know, as I think about us recording this program here in Milwaukee, which is once described as the toolbox of the world, the place that not only makes enormous amounts of material through the manufacturing process, but actually makes the tools that make the machines and so on.
Absolutely.
This has to be an issue that is incredibly important to the people who are employing many of our listeners.
I think it is. If we're talking about the importance of remanufacturing in this region, if as I said earlier, you know, the sector itself is dominated by small to medium sized manufacturers, and I think what we're seeing now, particularly with the economy showing signs of strength and recovery, is that companies are going to be faced with a very basic question of how do you match supply with demand, and so as business picks up, they're going to need the kind of talent that now helps them resolve those questions of matching supply with demand in their respective sectors. And so that's a question of how do you find good supply chain talent?
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak, and joining us in the studio is Anthony Ross. Anthony holds the endowed chair in supply chain management, sponsored by a wonderful company here, Rockwell Automation, with its world headquarters, and a good friend of UW Milwaukee. Anthony is an expert in supply chain processes, and as we've been hearing in the first part of this program, incredibly important to a lot of the companies like those that perhaps employ you as a listener here in the Metro Milwaukee area. Anthony, as I described the story or told the story of my father-in-law and the work that he did on these big machines, it brings me back to something that's a very relevant question on college campuses, which is, so how do we prepare our students for their careers? Are they going to be traveling around the world like my father-in-law, or what kind of jobs are out there that would help support this amazingly complex supply chain that you specialize in?
Yeah. Well, as I've had the opportunity in my first 4 years here in Milwaukee to meet decision makers in many companies in this region, one of the themes I've heard repeatedly from these decision makers is someone who's got the right level of emotional intelligence, a well-earned degree, and a passport, I'll hire them yesterday. And so the demand is there, I believe, and I think increasingly so, for supply chain talent. And the beauty for your listening audience, if you think about supply chain management, which really as a profession is only 25 to 30 years old, not that old. If you think about majoring in marketing or accounting at just any college besides just UW Milwaukee, which is a wonderful school, by the way, the kinds of areas that you work, you would be employed in with an accounting degree would be relative, you know, tax or audit. And if you're in marketing, sales or brand management. But the beauty of supply chain is that supply chain, at least our degree at UW Milwaukee, prepares our students to enter jobs in each of the major core functions of the supply chain, and that is sourcing or purchasing, making or manufacturing, or distribution or the movement of goods, and that's typically transportation and warehousing. So our degree affords our students the flexibility to start their careers in any one of those core supply chain processes, but then over the life of their career, Tom, they can jump and work at any part of the supply chain, upstream, manufacturing, or downstream. And regardless of the industry, they can jump and change industries as well. So that, I think that's an exciting degree because it gives students and our graduates the opportunity to reinvent themselves over the course of their career. And they will lose their fire or their passion or their mojo, we call it. But our degree and the things we do on campus give them the tools that equip them to rediscover their mojo over the life of their career.
You're housed in the Lubar School of Business. You're a business faculty member. And yet a lot of the systems that you're talking about involve engineering, perhaps involve chemistry if a company is making compounds and the like. So if you think about the job possibilities that are out there and you know the fact that there are all these companies that have needs.
Right.
And yet, as you describe these processes, the question I have is, does a student today have to be an expert in more than just business, since we make so many different kinds of things?
Sure.
You know, we make stuff using chemistry and other things, metallurgy.
Absolutely.
My head is spinning as I imagine this student in the supply chain program saying, how in the world do I get prepared for a process that seems to be needed almost everywhere?
Right. Sure. Sure. And I want to answer that in two different ways. The first way is, let's assume I'm at a company that traditionally hires engineers into my supply chain organization. And there are companies in this region that typically have that orientation. And there's nothing wrong with it. And they're very qualified technical people, I'm sure. But we're talking now about business strategy and understanding the cross-functional linkages. And our supply chain degree actually prepares our students to actually understand a little bit better those cross-functional linkages, working with a biologist or a metallurgist or even a mechanical engineer designing a new product or a new process or a new chemical compound. Or we work with transportation and civil engineers who are designing structures that need different types of specific sourcing practices or specifications to be developed and executed. So our degree prepares our students to be able to work in integrated cross-functional teams. That's my first point. The second point is a level of emotional intelligence that requires that students have the self-awareness to be able to interact with people who have different technical or non-technical opinions, because companies today, regardless of industry, are putting together cross-functional teams to address business challenges. And we need students who have the raw skills coming in, and that would be, you know, your basic math competency, your basic writing competency from any of our high schools, to come into Milwaukee and essentially take risks in this wonderful learning laboratory we called a four-year institution, to really develop their sense of self-awareness.
Because as you pointed out earlier in the program, your employers not only want students to come out of school with that skill set, but if they have that passport, that also is incredibly important, because this amazing process that you describe isn't just taking place here in Milwaukee or here in America. These supply chains stretch all over around the world, don't they?
Absolutely. And if I can tie that back to our previous discussion on remanufacturing, the remanufacturing industry here in the United States, I said, was about $43 billion. Of that $43 billion, roughly $16 billion of that revenue stream is associated with remanufacturing companies who are global. And so for supply chain students, that's job opportunities as well, so that extend beyond southeastern Wisconsin.
When you talk about remanufacturing, reusing, repurposing, a word comes to my mind, and I haven't heard you mention it yet, but I'm curious whether or not companies think about this, and that is sustainability. The notion that there is a limited amount of raw materials in the world. Is this a factor that enters into whether or not a company buys new or retools?
It certainly is. And there's a different orientation or set of criteria that companies might use depending on the industry. If you think, the healthcare sector, for example, and reusable and remanufacturable products in healthcare space. I'm thinking about things like beds, the Hillrom beds. I'm thinking about medical devices. I'm thinking about bedpans. Those wheelchairs, they call them trees that hang the IV bags on. There are a multitude of devices in the medical devices sector that are remanufactured, and there's a huge market for prosthetic devices of different sorts even. And then if you think about the consumer goods and the heavy industrial equipment, we call it HDOR, H-D-O-R, heavy-duty off-road equipment, machining and mining equipment, motion control, motor control devices. If you think about those kinds of products, companies have to think about the kinds of materials that go into the raw materials. Now, so now I'm thinking about minerals that go into making an aluminum or a titanium component, laced component. And there is a growing concern globally that we call them the rare earth minerals. We're going to run out of the rare earth minerals. And the pressure there on companies is that how can we design and invent newer types of components made out of newer kinds of minerals or materials or solutions that reduce our reliance upon these rare earth minerals. So the supply chain extends from the ground, the earth, where we extract the raw materials, back to Earth when we think about the end of life of a product, where we finally have to decompose and salvage a piece of equipment that is reached its end of life.
I'm thinking of that rhyme, the knee bones connected to the thigh bone, connected to the hip bone. There is some truth to that in the fact that there is this thread that runs through these incredibly complex processes.
Absolutely, up and down the supply chain. And I think it creates a wealth of opportunities for employment for those with a supply chain degree.
We just have a few minutes left, so let me ask you this question.
Sure.
So how far along are we in answering the questions that you and your colleagues are in the middle of posing? And are you hopeful that we're going to find some good solutions here, given the limited amount of natural resources that we have in the world?
Wow. Wow. If I knew the answer to that question, I think I could be nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship or the Nobel Prize. But I'm not quite high enough. Sure. But no, I think your question is actually quite relevant. The challenge for firms today is to be able to make their products faster, cheaper, better, smarter in today's environment. And I think technology forever is changing the way we live, eat, and play.
Well, and we talked about the Internet of Things. That wasn't around 15 years ago.
Not at all.
So who can imagine what new concept or process might come into this supply chain system that we're talking about?
Well, sure. I mean, speaking of the Internet of Things, you know, I was talking to someone today. The Apple Corporation has these new devices now that monitor the state of your physical body, and it could help you help improve your quality of life in many ways. I forgot what the device is called.
It's a mood ring, is it? No. That's when I was growing up. Never mind.
That's from the 60s or 70s, right? Yeah, I forgot what it's called today, Jawbone or something. I've forgotten. But, you know, that device essentially, for example, gives me reminders at work when I'm sitting at my desk too long and tells me, get up and go take a walk. It's changing the quality of our life. I'm talking about technology. It's changing the way we live, work, eat, and play. And I think technology could be a platform that is quite beneficial to our society globally.
Fascinating. Fascinating work. Always a pleasure to have you on, Anthony. And
it's my great pleasure.
Continue the great work you and your colleagues both at UWM and at Rockwell Automation and the other companies that you're working with in this fascinating study of supply chain management.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a good pleasure to see you.
Anthony Ross, who's one of the stars in the Lubar School of Business. He's got the endowed chair in supply chain management, sponsored by Rockwell Automation, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.